The 920 KVEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kvec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 01111911.
It is time to begin the 4 o'clock hour on this Tuesday, April 23rd, 2022. I'm Dave Congleton. Good to be with you. We're busy today. Still to come on this broadcast, Dan Shadwell checks in during the 5 o'clock hour. Mitch Massey at 6:05 is going to explain to us Prop 26 and Prop 27. We've got not one, but two ballot initiatives on the November ballot dealing with sports betting. They both call for the same thing, but there's also a big difference. Mitch will explain. And we're just kind of curious, just want to test the waters a little bit and see how in late August you're feeling about legalizing all that. I also want to give a shout out. We had the folks here yesterday from the Diversity Coalition of San Luis Obispo County. Their historian is going to be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Slo Public Market. That is free and open to the public if you want to hear that presentation. This hour, speaking of history, always good to be in conversation with one of our resident local historians, Dr. James Papp. We invite Dr. Papp to come into the studio from time to time to share with us local history. What I asked James to do this time is kind of put together a list of people. I mean, there are certain people that we know of in terms of our history, I would hope, where it's Mr. Sinsheimer or Alex Madonna or whatever, Walter Murray. But there are also a whole slew of people who had a big role in this county that I've been here 35 years, and I'm looking at this list. I've never heard of any of these people. Why am I here when Dr. Papp is back with us? Dr. Papp, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's nice to be with you all out there in Radio Land.
I suspect you'd spend a lot of time reading about local history because you're not from here. You came here, and you probably know more about the city than most people.
Well, I don't claim to know more than most people. What I know is very specialized. The business I'm in as an architectural historian and a historian is that one of the things I do is people come to me with their house and say, you know, I want to master list my house. Could you look into it? And I look into the history, and you discover amazing skeletons, sometimes really good people, sometimes really bad people. Yeah. And what to me is important is that my sort of lifelong belief that comes from the various heroes I have and have had growing up, from my father to all kinds of other random people, is that you do make a difference. Individuals can make a big difference. And this is called the great man theory of history. But it doesn't have to be a great man or indeed a great woman or indeed a great anybody else. It just has to be someone who says, okay, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to step in and change the way things are for the better.
Yeah.
Or occasionally the worse. But I would say that most people who change them for the worse actually believe they're changing them for the better. So we'll see some of those people.
Well, let's give an example here. This is perfect. I have never heard of this woman before. We're going to talk about Mary Gale Black.
So Mary Gale Black, if you were around in San Luis Obispo in the 1920s, you would have known her because she was the first bylined reporter on the Telegram. Nobody else was having their name printed. It was a very small staff, though there were a lot of correspondents from 24 different county towns. But she was the first one to get a byline. I don't know why she got that honor, but she was basically, her father was a rancher in Wyoming. In Wyoming, women had the vote. Very important. So her mother, grandmother had the vote, and her father was in the state legislature. He had problems with his lungs, so they moved out to Pasadena. She graduated from high school and immediately went to work for one of the local papers, and then went to work for another of the local papers, and then for another of the local papers, moving her way up from Pasadena, South Pasadena to Los Angeles papers with larger and larger circulation. When she left her L.A. paper, she was the only woman on the staff who was not in the social department. She moved up to San Luis Obispo because her sister lived in Oceano. Her father had died. She was bringing her mother up to live here and applied for a job on the Telegram. We actually had three newspapers. Can you believe it?
This is 1920s.
In the early 1920s. There was the Tribune, which ran advertisements for bars, and therefore a rival paper was started that would not run a temperance paper that would not run ads for bars, and that was the Telegram. But the temperance people weren't even happy with that, so they started a third newspaper called the Obispan, later the Herald, which was very openly pro-temperance, pro-prohibition.
So it's the Tribune, the Telegram, and the Herald.
Yes, and they've all been folded into one paper since then. And the Tribune, of course, was the oldest, founded by Walter Murray in 1869. So Mary Gale Black goes to work for it, and the publisher apparently likes her enough that he starts putting her name on columns. And they even sort of write about her in the social columns, so she becomes a bit of a personality. And some of the columns that she writes, it's always fascinating how she does this, because she's in this very small town. They've got to get the news in by the evening. And so, because their motto is that day's news that day. So she entertains herself by going, one of my favorite articles by her, she entertains herself by going to the library. We have this great public library now, the History Center, that Carnegie Library. And so she would write an article about the new books that had come in. Which, you know, doesn't sound like that exciting a news article.
But I love it.
But she would relate it to the big news of the day. For instance, that there would be a new book on Darwinism. And, of course, that was going on because there was the great battle between William Jennings Bryan and, now I've forgotten the name of
Clarence Darrow.
Thank you. So she, Clarence Darrow, over whether they could... not whether they could teach Darwinism, but whether they could prosecute someone who had mentioned Darwinism in a Georgia school. I think it was Georgia, may have been Alabama. Any rate, so she would grab onto these. And one of the great things she grabbed onto was when they were filming down in the Oceano Dunes, filming the Ten Commandments. And so she went down there and did a series of three articles on Hollywood from the backstage, basically. She wrote about all the technical aspects of it, and that really preceded people getting into, you know, the technical aspects of Hollywood, which was always, of course, pushing out publicity. You just wanted to see the stars. You wanted to see the spectacles.
Was she the only woman at the Telegram in the 20s?
Here's an interesting wrinkle.
Outside the social pages.
She was the only woman. It was a very tiny staff. She was the only woman on the reporting staff. Right. There was another woman who was the office manager, a woman named Mildred Waterman, who had actually encouraged the publisher to hire, quote, that brash young woman from Oceano. And Mildred Waterman and Mary Gale Black eventually formed a partnership. They moved in together in adobe called the Similar Adobe on Dana Street. They traveled around together. They socialized together. Whenever, you know, there was some social column, their names would be paired, as it was with all the married couples. The closest anyone ever got to describing their partnership in the press was to say when Mary Gale Black came back for her mother's death from Porterville, and Mildred Waterman came with her, they had moved to the next paper owned by that publisher. They explained it by saying they were very close personal friends. But they bought property together. Mary Gale Black eventually went off to UC Berkeley and then to Smith College for a master's degree. was offered a job at Time Magazine, but Mildred Waterman had just been fired. This was the height of the Depression, so came back to help her out. Then moved to Sacramento, eventually came back at the end of World War II, settled down with Mildred, and they lived the rest of their lives together in the similar adobe.
Now, explain in terms of Mary Gail Black, then she became known for cancer.
Yeah, so Mildred Waterman was the assistant registrar at the county health department, and Mary Gail Black, and she got a job for Mary Gail Black there as well. These were not very munificent jobs, but had to be done. And Mary Gail Black then took out her ambitions, I would say, in work for the community. And there's an interesting thing when you're looking at how society is organized in the United States, be it small towns or big cities, but especially small towns. You had a lot of fraternal organization like the Elks or the Odd Fellows or the Masons. Women had civic groups. Then around World War II, you begin to move to purpose-driven groups that have some particular thing that they need to get done. And one of those is the American Cancer Society. And before World War II, the American Cancer Society actually put women in uniform. Their volunteers in uniform had a huge core of uniformed cancer workers to go out and sort of spread the word about cancer. And then after World War II, in the 1950s, they set up this huge study called the Cancer Prevention Study 1, CPS 1. And in San Luis Obispo, the Cancer Society was actually under the chairmanship of a brigadier general. That's how serious they were. And Mary Gail Black, who was a former newspaper woman and might well have been someone that you'd want to do publicity, she volunteered to run that study for San Luis Obispo County. Now, this is a study that had almost 1 million participants, that had 68,000 volunteers communicating with those participants. And in San Luis Obispo, there were upwards of 400 participants, 20 volunteers who were communicating with them, and Mary Gail Black, who was running those 20 volunteers. She did that for 6 years until the study was finished. One of the big results of that study was that the rise in women's cancer was very specifically connected to the rise in tobacco smoking.
Wow.
And so out of this study came directly the war on cancer that was started at the federal level. And Mary Gail Black switched from running this group of volunteers to being the publicity person and the education person, the education chair. And she went out for a decade promulgating these results and trying to get people in the press, at libraries, doing films, whatever she could do to get people to stop smoking.
Sounds like a really impressive woman. Did she live out her days here?
She did indeed. Okay. And that was only one aspect of what she was up to, because she got involved in Adlai Stevenson's first campaign, running it for San Luis Obispo, and then, or volunteering at least in San Luis Obispo. Then she began to chair local political campaigns.
All right. We are in conversation with Dr. James Papp, putting the focus on some folks from our history that you may not be familiar with and telling their stories. We've got more stories to share. I'm Dave Congleton. We're live. We're local. This is Hometown Radio. My mic, there we go. It's stuck. It's 421 on KVEC. I'm Dave Congleton. Dr. James Papp is here. I'm sorry, I'm just fascinated. I never heard of this woman before. She lived until 1989. Some of our listeners probably knew Mary Gail Black. She died in San Luis Obispo at the age of 91. She died on July 30th, 1989. This is her.
And really was going strong right to the end. I mean, she's an inspiration to us all. But as I mentioned just before the break, she got involved in politics. And her father had been a Republican. She was a Democrat. And she began to chair the local campaigns of whoever was running in this congressional district, because things were divided up by county. So she would do the San Luis Obispo campaign, or she'd do the San Luis Obispo. She did the San Luis Obispo campaign for Senator McCarthy's run for the presidency until he didn't win the primary. And then they switched to the Al Cranston Club. and got Cranston elected. And any rate, one of the most interesting campaigns she did was for Suzanne Pazis, which I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who was a school teacher from Santa Cruz and was one of, and this is just one of these what moments, she was one of the first two women simultaneously nominated by their party to run for California State Senate. In 1972, we had been a state, there had been a California State Senate for 122 years before either of the parties, any of the parties nominated a woman. And they both ran. They both lost. It was a very conservative district at that time. Hmm. Santa Cruz, University of Santa Cruz, the students voted, I think, 92% for McGovern and 91% for Suzanne Pazis.
That sounds like Santa Cruz.
But outside of the university, it's a very conservative place.
But Mary Gail Black also was a Diablo Canyon protester.
Yeah, so she ran that campaign. Then I'm going to interject one other quite amazing thing that she did, which has had a lasting effect. In the early 1960s, President Kennedy set up something called the United States Commission on the Status of Women. And this was really the beginning of second wave feminism. Eleanor Roosevelt was the chair of the commission, and they wrote really a very good, thoughtful book about what the problems were, legal, social, et cetera, facing women. And then state commissions began to be set up. And then finally, it got down to the county level. And Suzanne Pazis managed to get a county commission passed in Santa Cruz. And Mary Gail Black wanted to do that in San Luis Obispo County. So she and Carol McPhee, who is one of the daughters of Julian McPhee, the president of Cal Poly, got together. And Mary Gail Black sort of let Carol McPhee take the reins on this, because they had this very interesting fight. Carol McPhee has written a fascinating book about it called A Small Town Women's Movement, which you can buy at Coalesce Bookstore or now get out of the San Luis Obispo City Library, because I donated a copy because I thought it was such a great book. It was sort of this younger woman, older woman struggle, and Carol McPhee wanted to spread out the campaign to a wider demographic of women. And so Mary Gail Black let her do that, let her take charge, and they got this commission passed by, with a budget of $3,000, passed by the Board of Supervisors in 1975. And that commission is still going strong.
Mm.
So they got office space in the county building, then they were thrown out of their office space and back and forth. But this was a time when there were all kinds of differential laws for women. And it was a major advance for women to even get these kinds of things looked at.
And then Mary Gail Black went on and, as I mentioned, protested Diablo Canyon.
Yes, and on the Lompoc Sentinel, or whatever the name of their paper down there is, she was pictured on the front page with Daniel Ellsberg next to her, scaling a ladder into the Diablo Canyon site. It was the first mass takeover of that site. There ended up being three mass takeovers, which was the largest in any protest for any nuclear power plants in the country. And so she was this fair. The interesting thing, she always shaved a few years off her age. She was actually 77 when she climbed over that ladder. But her age was given variously as 72 and some in between. But she made the papers all over the state for that act.
So she started off as an award-winning journalist, groundbreaking journalist, and she ends up being an activist protesting a nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
Among all these other things.
Never slows down. And she and Mildred Waterman were deeply interested in San Luis Obispo history. And Mildred Waterman had, I don't know if it really intentionally or it just happened to be on the market, had bought the similar adobe on Dana Street with her father in 1927. And she and Mary Gail Black came to believe that the adobe was built in the Rancho era, the Mexican era, but that the garden went all the way back to the Mission Fathers. And so they carefully took care of these two things, the garden and the adobe. And they also bought another adobe between them, which had to be sold when Mildred Waterman died. Mary Gail Black was disconsolate and so donated her adobe to the city to be preserved for public recreation.
We're in conversation with Dr. James Papp, introducing us to people synonymous with San Luis Obispo history that we may not be aware of. We've got news and traffic and weather. More names on the way. This is Hometown Radio. If you're just joining us, our guest for the hour is Dr. James Papp, local historian extraordinaire. We bring him in from time to time to regale us with stories about the history of our community. One of the things we've been talking about today is picking out some names of folks that you may not have heard from or heard of, but I think they're pretty fascinating. We talked a lot about Mary Gail Black. Now we want to throw out a couple of teachers' names. There's D.M. Meredith. And then what's the other name, please?
Thomas Levin Brachin.
Both teachers. One went that way and one went that way.
Those of you in radio land can't see where Dave is pointing.
Yeah, they get the
Could
idea.
Be up and down.
Yeah.
Really interesting because, you know, not only teachers, but elementary school teachers. So in the early 19th century when these late 19th century, early 20th century, when these two gentlemen were operating, elementary school teaching was mostly a woman's profession, and the men tended to gravitate to the older grade levels. And that's actually part of how they became as dominant as they did, because if there was any man around, they would become principal. But we had, because they didn't want to choose the women. But David Milton Meredith was the son of a farmer in Kansas. Came out to California with his wife. Had been had gotten some education, had been a clerk, but it's not really clear that he had any teaching education or experience before he showed up in the 1870s at Port San Luis, and then began to teach at tiny local schools. And one of the interesting things about California education at this time, this was the period when they were moving into compulsory education for kids, about 8 to 14. This had started in Massachusetts in 1852 was the first time there had been compulsory elementary school education. We got it in California, I believe, about 24 years later, 22, 24 years later. And we had little tiny districts, and each district had a board of three trustees. And very often, the district only had one teacher. So you had three trustees, one teacher, a lot of chiefs, only one Indian. And one of the problems was this was, an attractive office for people with bad intentions. Political types, et cetera, people weren't particularly interested in education because it gave them a lot of power without much work. Any rate, so David Milton Meredith shows up, and in a couple of years, they decide to make him the principal of San Luis Obispo's schools, which consisted at that time of two, the mission school and the court school.
Okay.
And he's teaching first grade, and he's the principal of the school because everybody else is a woman. He is the only man, I believe, on the entire staff of about 14 or so. May have even been smaller. Any rate, he then is fired as principal the next year, is retained as a teacher, but over the next few years, the board of trustees keeps firing and hiring and firing and hiring, and the recurrent headline in the newspaper is school troubles. It's always someone, a teacher beat one of the students who was the son or daughter, never a daughter, it's always the son of some prominent person in town, or they sue the school district, or it's one problem after another. So Meredith stays on for a while as a teacher, but then he goes into the insurance business. And he's appointed to the county board of education. And I've got to and he's also, by the way, a founder and a deacon of the local Baptist church. And I have to read you this tiny snippet from a newspaper, one of the local newspapers, which says a white opium joint is reported to have been opened at the lower end of Monterey Street, which will not live long as the police will close it up. D.M. Meredith, this guy we're talking about, is erecting a fine one-story Queen Anne edifice in his, on his Broad Street lot, which will be occupied by Ung Sing and Company as a wash house and private opium joint. So here you have a member of the school board of the county who's running, who's basically renting an opium joint. And you might think that's very odd. But what's odd about it is not that it's going on, because as you see from that little snippet of local news, whites aren't allowed to have opium. It's only Chinese. There's this division there. But at the time...
What, in what year are we talking about,
roughly? We're talking about the 1880s.
Okay.
Just as Meredith showed up in San Luis Obispo, there was, in California and in San Luis Obispo, there was a huge anti-Chinese campaign. There was the Working Men's Party, which whose slogan was, "The Chinese must go." And the Working Men's Party candidate for the superintendent of county education was running on an anti-Chinese platform. And so the combined Republican-Democratic ticket to oppose him also had "The Chinese Must Go" as its slogan. What did this have to do with local education? There was a very tiny Chinese population in San Luis Obispo County at the time. It's about 1.7% of the population, as opposed to the rest of California, it was about 9%. And because school was now being required and was state funded, a census was taken of all the school children in San Luis Obispo, city of San Luis Obispo, and there were over 500 of them. And all 500 but 11 were accounted for in the schools. Those 11 consisted of 10 Chinese children and one Indian. They were not admitted to the schools. So for the a member of the school board to actually be renting to a Chinese person was revolutionary. And this was in the middle of something called the Chinese Laundry Wars that went on for about 15 years in San Luis Obispo City and involved the opening of something called the Caucasian Steam Laundry so that people would not have to go to a Chinese laundry to have their clothes clean, and culminated finally in a bombing of one of the Chinese laundries, at which point the city said enough and sort of settled things down.
We had the Chinese Laundry Wars.
Yes. And the city was actually on one side of that. They were trying to close down the Chinese laundries and were accusing them of blocking up the drains. And then when people actually went down and investigated the drains, it was all construction stuff. It was not the soap suds from the Chinese laundries. So they tried to close down the Chinese laundries. A judge kept them open. It went back and forth in the courts, but also, as I say, bombings, rocks being thrown through windows, everything. And one of the great things about Walter Murray, who actually started the thing called the driving out of the Chinese in Tuolumne County, he was the editor of a newspaper before he ever came to San Luis, and started a campaign to drive all Chinese people out of Tuolumne County and then out of California, but the rest of California didn't really sign on yet. But when he came to San Luis Obispo, he had some sort of deep-seated conversion. And when he was running the Tribune, he actually editorialized that anyone who threw a rock through the window of a Chinese laundry should be treated like they treated stray dogs in New York and drown them. He actually wrote that in the newspaper.
Well, let me guide you back to D.M. Meredith.
Yeah. So D.M. Meredith, his kind of claim to fame, or his two claims to fame. So he goes in and out of teaching for a while, but eventually goes into the insurance business. And he gets he spends 24 years on the Board of Education, the local educational district board of trustees, and the new city board of education. But at the same time, J.P. Andrews, of who is a hog farmer who turns to banking and opens the Andrews Bank, which still the building still exists and is now Cobarolet Blue at the corner of just by the courthouse. He gets D.M. Meredith to be his cashier, which is the second in command at the bank. And in 1899, we're going through a big drought. And Ari Jack is the cashier at a rival bank. And this is
of the Jack House.
Of the Jack House and the Jack family. Mm-hmm. And Ari Jack's claim to expertise in banking comes down to the fact that he was extremely rich because he had married, I'm forgetting her first name. Her mother was Ellen. Can't remember her. Nellie Hollister. One of the Hollisters who had brought sheep to California, after whom all sorts of Hollister things are named, although not the T-shirts. So he becomes cashier of the rival county bank of San Luis Obispo County. And one day on a Friday afternoon, he nails to the door a kind of flippant notice that says, you know, there's just not enough money around to make it worth doing business, so they're going to close for a while. This sets off a bank panic. Bank in those days are open on Saturdays. The next day, there is a run on the commercial bank, which is owned by a friend of Jack's, McDowell Reed Venable, and it manages to survive for 15 minutes, and it shuts down. The only bank, Jack has some banks up in the North County in Paso Robles, as does Venable. They shut down on Saturday. The only bank that stays open, the only major bank that stays open is J.P. Andrews Bank.
Because of D.M. Meredith.
Because of D.M. Meredith and Andrews having made sure that there was plenty of cash on hand and making statements. I mean, literally, Venable went out and in the press made a statement that he was sure his bank was going to be ruined and blamed the public. That's not a good PR move. Whereas Meredith went public and said, people are taking out their money only to put it right back in.
So did Meredith leave teaching altogether?
He did.
Or is he doing both at once?
By this point, he's left teaching altogether, but he stays on the Board of Trustees of San Luis. So simultaneously, he is running this bank and is on the Board of Trustees of the school board. And his big project for the 12 years that he is reelected to the local, it's called the Mission, our local district was called the Mission District, was to get a high school built and operating, because we didn't have a high school. These little tiny school districts, none of them was really big enough to support a high school. So the California came up with a system where they would combine districts in order to create a high school. Paso built one, Arroyo Grande built one, Cambria built one. We started one and nobody wanted to pay the taxes and it failed.
So we were late to the game in terms of building
high schools. We were very late to the game.
You'd think we'd be first.
Here we were the county capital, as it were. And so Meredith worked and worked to pass bond issues and eventually built this beautiful high school in 1906, designed by William Henry Weeks, who also designed a number of buildings around town that still exist. The first buildings of Cal Poly, which have been torn down. The Carnegie Library, he designed that. So he designed this beautiful stone high school. And in the 1930s, after the Long Beach earthquake, they decided it was earthquake unsafe because it was unreinforced masonry, decided to knock it down. Almost were unable to knock the thing down because it was so solidly built.
All right, we are in conversation with Dr. James Papp, regaling us with stories of our past and some of the more interesting people he's come across in his research about San Luis Obispo. We have a final segment underway as we continue right here on KVEC. We are in our final segment with historian Dr. James Papp, introducing us to people we may not know about in terms of the history of this community. We start off talking a little bit about Mary Gail Black. We talked about the teacher turned banker D.M. Meredith. And then we've got this other one I want to make sure we have time for. This is T.L. Brechin.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And also a teacher.
Yes, also an elementary school teacher.
But went a totally different direction than D.M. Meredith.
He started out as an elementary school teacher and ended up leading the Jackson County Rebellion, which I will tell you more about.
All right.
But yes, when teachers go bad. Well, I mean, it was not a very lucrative profession. And that's why women were most of the teachers. They weren't making much money. And so Tom Brachin, as he was later known, was born in Texas, like Meredith, the son of a farmer. Apart from the U.S. Census, there's really no paper trail there until he shows up in California. And he joins a one-room schoolhouse, the Simi Valley Schoolhouse, and there's one other teacher. She's a woman. So, of course, he's the principal.
What year are we talking about, roughly?
We're talking about, this is 1903.
Okay.
So he ends up becoming the principal of the Cambria School, which has two other teachers, both of them women. So, of course, he's the principal. Then they they put him on the Board of Education for the county. He becomes president of the Board of Education, and they hire him for the San Luis Obispo schools. And he, to his credit, I would say he was probably a psychopath. I would say he probably had no conscience. He was all transactional. He was certainly a narcissist. And he was very Machiavellian. He was always up to plans, and he was probably paranoid as well. But that makes for a very interesting historical figure. He comes in, he's principal, and he gets into trouble for flogging the sons of local luminaries for disobedience, because he told them to go home and not to bother the girls, and they refused, and so he flogged them. However, he survived this scandal. It became a huge thing in the newspapers, and people wrote for miles around from its earlier schools to say what a great guy he was. And at Christmas, he was given a gold-plated Waterman pen by his students. So, you know, here's this mark of everybody loves him. And I think, as with many psychopaths, he probably had people in both camps. He was terrible. He was wonderful. The following year, he feels he has been promised to take the entire class of eighth graders. The school board of trustees says, no, we want to split it into two groups and give the other half to the woman who's vice principal, because there's too many kids. There's 50 kids. He thereupon, even though he has gotten married like 2 weeks before, he resigns his position. And then they throw him out of the school board. And then he says, oh, well, I've been offered a principalship up in Alameda County. He goes up there. He hasn't. He has been offered he manages to find a teaching position. But he moves from school to school in Northern California, where he gets on the good side of the press and they say wonderful things about him. Then he moves to the next school the next year, and there's all these scandals that are left behind. And at one point, they're chasing him to be arrested in the middle of the Spanish flu for endangering the students at I think the series school. But by that time, he's moved on to Livermore. Livermore, he tries to get involved in the Board of Trustees election. And so the Board of Trustees is not happy about that. So they investigate him. And one of the things they find is that all of his credentials are bogus.
Ha!
He claims to have a degree from the University of California, not true. From the University of Texas, not true. He's also been claiming he ran all these schools in Texas. There's no evidence of that. And so he is forced to resign. Well, he's fired. He's not forced to resign. He battles this, and he becomes a real estate agent. And he is probably the most disastrous real estate agent in California history.
You're saying he was no Lindsey Horne?
He is no Lindsey Horne.
Okay.
He is eventually, it's fascinating what he does. He gets into street fights with realtors that he works for, or real estate agents that he works for. He embezzles money from clients. He steals things from building sites. I mean, he's just completely out of control. He's arrested at his parents-in-law house. And eventually the state insurance, the state real estate commissioner, because the state has now just decided we need to start regulating this business, not because of Tom Brachin, but Tom Brachin becomes the poster child for this. The state real estate commissioner cancels his real estate license. This newly appointed real estate commissioner in this new office cancels his real estate license for, amongst other things, embezzlement and moral turpitude. And so he goes to Oregon Well, no, he doesn't. The first thing is he sues and says the real estate commissioner doesn't have this ability, goes all the way to the California Supreme Court. California Supreme Court rules against Tom Brachin. Then the next year, the state real estate commissioner refuses to give him a new license. He sues over this as well and takes it all the way to the California Supreme Court, which again rules against him. Whereupon he, two interesting things happen. One, in the next census, his divorced wife, who has divorced him, claims she's a widow. And then he moves to Oregon and he gets involved in a group called the Good Government Congress, which is a group which is not particularly interested in democratic norms. This apparently was a early depression phenomenon. People were very unhappy. You know, people were losing money. You had the rise of Nazism and communism and all these other isms. And you had these local groups who were getting excited, and these ones went over good government. So they managed to get a local sheriff elected and a local judge elected in Jackson County. However, apparently dishonestly. And when it came time for the state government to do a recount, Brachin, who was part of this group, and the others took 10,000 ballots out of the county courthouse, dumped half of them in the Rogue River, fed the other half into the county jail's stove. And when they came to arrest the leader of this group, who was the editor of one of the local daily papers, he shot the constable who was serving the arrest papers. So the leader went to prison for the rest of his life. Brachin was given a 2-year sentence, was out in a year. He next shows up in Los Angeles, living in a boarding house at the edge of Japantown, working as a researcher for the local school district. How the mighty have fallen. And the sort of the interesting and poignant part about this, where blood is thicker than water, his daughter, remember his wife was claiming to be a widow. His daughter was a sorority girl in Berkeley, married a up-and-coming executive from Los Angeles, became a social figure in California. And she apparently found her father and took him in to her fashionable Toluca Lake house. Simultaneously, his wife was living there, her mother, Mae Morris. And he died there. By then, he had dementia and pleurisy and various things. But after he died, she became a major fixture on the social scene. Her eldest daughter became a much reported on and touted debutante in Los Angeles. And having been a debutante, got her degree at UCLA and became an elementary school teacher.
Wow. And he started off as a school teacher.
He started off as a school teacher with no qualifications, all bogus. She actually got correct qualifications. I believe she is still alive, and she went into sort of educational consulting. But it's just a story that goes all the way around.
Dr. James Papp, always fascinating, always glad to be in conversation with you. Thank you for telling stories about people of San Luis Obispo. I got about 30 seconds for a final perspective.
My final perspective is you can always make a difference. You can make a difference for good. You can make a difference for bad. But never think that you can't get in there if you see something that needs to be improved. However little it is, however big it is, just do it.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Off we go. We've got ABC Radio News. Craig updates us with time saver traffic and weather together. We've got Dan Shadwell followed by Mitch Massey. It's a KSBY reunion right here on Hometown Radio.
The 920 KBEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kbec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 0111-911.